Welcome to The Downtime Project, where we learn from the internet's most notable outages. I'm Tom Kleinbeter, and with me is Jamie Turner.
Hi.
Before we begin, I just want to remind our listeners that these incidents are really stressful, and we peel them apart to learn, not to judge. Ultimately, Jamie and I have made, and we will in the future undoubtedly make, similar mistakes on our own projects. So please view these conversations as education rather than judgment of mistakes we think we would never make. Today we're talking about the GitLab outage from January 31st, 2017. Let's set a little bit of context and then walk through the timeline. GitLab published a great overview. They also had a live document during the actual outage they were updating. But let's set a little bit of background and then run through the timeline.
Cool. Sounds good. So the zoomed out version here of what happened is there was a database load incident at GitLab that caused the site to be degraded. And while attempting to get the site back online, some mistakes were made that caused database data to go missing. And then the GitHub had to work through various ways to restore that data, and at the end of the day, 24 hours after the incident began, they were back online, but without incurring some data loss. So we're going to kind of explore, the context around their systems and sort of what state they were in when this all started. Then we'll kind of walk through the sequence of events here as it unraveled.
Yeah. Okay, so like so many companies, at this point, GitLab had one monolithic database server in production. It had a primary replica pair running Postgres. So I guess technically they had two, but they had one primary with pretty much everything on it. They also had a staging cluster where they could validate new code, which is a good practice. So they would take a snapshot from production, remove a little bit of data from it, and ship it over to the staging cluster where they could try out new code with realistic data in a secure way and make sure everything was working. So the staging work was done via LVM snapshots, but they did also have a scheduled pgdump run where pgdump's a tool for just taking a snapshot of a Postgres database. So they would run this every 24 hours and upload it to an S3 bucket. In the weeks before the outage, they were having a couple of sort of sporadic load issues, which these can be particularly bad when, you just have one database, because, one bad actor can, get your primary database slow, which can make things slow for everybody. So GitLab was looking into ways they could distribute the load across more backend databases. So the issue seemed to be caused by spam, according to the postmortem, but yep. They don't get into a ton of details about what exactly that means, and it's not really relevant for the outage.
Cool, yeah. So that's sort of the state of play as we begin here with the time sequence. So about 90 minutes before they started having site issues related to, as Tom just mentioned, the load issues they were starting to encounter on a regular basis, someone on the engineering team was playing around with using pgpool to load balance traffic between multiple database servers. And in order to begin safely testing this deployment, the engineer was going to use their staging cluster. And so the engineer took an LVM snapshot, a newer one, because as Tom mentioned, every 24 hours staging would use an LVM snapshot in order to mirror production and have a copy. But in order to do this testing, the engineer decided to take an even fresher snapshot before they began testing. And so they did that. So they took an LVM snapshot of production and then ostensibly began testing pgpool in the staging cluster.
It's not totally clear why they needed a more recent snapshot. I would have thought one from yesterday would be fine, but this is actually going to be really important, and some of the best luck they end up having in the next 24 hours.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. This actual exercise the engineer was doing, it doesn't actually contribute to going down, but it ends up mattering later in a way we'll discover as we go here. So anyway, 90 minutes later, official start of the outage, the load-related site degradation, and basically GitLab started noticing that their performance was degrading on the site, committing comments was starting to fail, various other things, a familiar pattern to them, and their dashboards and things indicated it was database load related. So since they were familiar with these kinds of things due to spam in previous weeks, they assumed this was probably especially bad spam attack in similar to the others in a way they didn't completely understand yet. It was learned that the actual cause of the extra database load is it appears that GitLab has a kind of abuse report flag kind of mechanism, and some sort of pattern had occurred where enough reports were issued against someone that the deletion kicked off, basically some sort of account removal or something. And it may be in a trolling kind of way. These reports were being issued about a GitLab employee who had a ton of data in the system. So an especially expensive delete operation began kicked off as a result of this automation, trying to deprovision the account.
So one thing there is that this was actually a real deletion of the employee's data. It wasn't just like a soft deletion. You know, that a lot of times if you have data that gets deleted from your system, it's much better to market delete it. And then hopefully that can be a very cheap operation. And then if you do it right, you can defer the really expensive work until there's a better time. So like, rather than trying to delete everything about this employee, you could just go mark their root account row as deleted and then just have things ignore them.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, that would have helped. But yeah, so I guess the combination of maybe the usual sort of background spam type behavior and this large delete caused too much load and maybe cascading failure because the overall load issues persisted for several hours. About 4 hours in, where these load issues still seem to be ongoing to some degree. And one of the consequences of that additional load is that the secondary, the replica database server, was starting to lag very far behind the primary. So the primary had transactions committed from quite a while ago that had not yet made it to the secondary. And as this gap increased, it started to become a problem.
Yeah. So this is a pretty standard problem that I've certainly seen before, where, you know, if you're not familiar with the way replication logs or transaction logs work with a primary replica setup, you know, you'll run all your writes on your primary, and as these writes happen, it's going to write out the transaction log, which is the record of everything that's happened, all the writes that have happened on that machine. This is going to be shipped over, or just, you know, sent over a socket to the replica, and the replica is just going to apply those locally. So like the queries just have to run on the replica as well. So if you get into a situation where you get a ton of writes coming into the system, you know, the secondary can just back up, you know, actually applying all these writes. And so the logs just continue to build up on the primary. And eventually that can be a problem. You know, if you have some limit on how big the logs can get, you know, the replication will just break and then you're stuck because the replica is now out of sync and has to get a new copy from the primary before it can pick up the log again.
Yep. So yeah, and that is what happened in this case. So eventually the primary began to evict some of the logs. And unfortunately those logs had not yet been propagated and applied to the secondary. So standard replication stream was no longer going to be sufficient to be able to get the secondary back in sync with the primary. So when this happened, you know, the option that becomes available is basically batch restoration. So instead of using this transaction log, you need to sort of go back to the raw data on the primary and start to re-replicate. Essentially everything is the easiest way to get a secondary that's very close to the master again, so that you can begin normal replication, normal streaming replication. And GitLab knew this, so they shifted into, okay, we need to completely re-replicate the primary. And so an engineer swung into action, and the tool that GitLab had decided to use to do this is a tool called PG Base Backup. And PG Base Backup, you can point it at a primary, and it will re-replicate the entire state of that primary. And then they can start up the secondary, and everything will be okay again. So they ran this tool a few times, and the tool wasn't really working for them. PG-based backup, they had not used it very much before. It wasn't giving a lot of good error output. They had to reconfigure things several times on the primary in order for it to have enough resources available to kick off this big batch replication. And in the course of these restarts, they eventually got to the place where they had the master up and running, and they believed they had the resources configured correctly. And so when they were going to kick this off, if you're going to do a from scratch replication, that what they did is they, on the secondary, they removed the data directory. So they removed all the Postgres's data, so there was kind of a clean slate to replicate into. And after several invocations of PG-based backup that had failed, and getting the master back online with the number of resources they thought were going to be necessary for this batch replication, they tried one more time to run PG-based backup, and it still wasn't working. And they really did not know why. However, they had a theory, and that theory is when things got kind of interesting again. So the team thought that PG-based backup was maybe silently refusing to begin this replication because the failed attempts at running it before had populated some files into the data directory, but not obviously not the complete set because it had not finished. And so they thought, oh, maybe we should wipe the data directory again, and so that PG-based backup will run. And unfortunately, and I think this is, we've all been here before, when they reissued the delete the data directory command at the shell, they were on the primaries command line and not the secondaries command line. So they removed the data directory from the primary.
Oh, man, I know exactly how that would have felt. Like, that is really the worst feeling you can possibly have when you're working on an outage. You know, you type in some command, you hit enter, and it takes longer than you think it should. And you look at your terminal, you look at the prompt maybe, and you just, oh my God, you control C. You know, maybe you hope for a second it's not as bad as you think, but oh no, you just really did the thing. And there's just no getting back from it. It's just this, oh, it's so bad. Just that it is a physical feeling in your stomach when you do something like that. So my personal nightmare here is mixing up the C and the X when I'm using tar to move something around. But it is so easy to annihilate something just with the stock Linux. So, oh my God, I feel so bad.
Yeah, I've absolutely been there too, and I agree. Usually that sinking feeling in your stomach kicks in when the command takes longer than you thought. And it sounds like a similar thing happened here because they also killed the command, but not after, unfortunately, it did enough damage to render the primary not having a complete data set. So for all intents and purposes at this point, GitLab had lost their entire database, and they needed to start looking at backup options.
And this is, they lost the primary when they already did not have complete data on the secondary.
So yeah. Yep.
There's nothing there anymore.
I mean, the net result, unfortunately, accidentally, out of the attempting this batch replication is they removed the data directory on the secondary to replicate into it. And then they accidentally removed the data directory on the primary when they were attempting to remove it on the secondary. So no data on either machine. And now you're in backup land.
On to the backups.
Yep. So at this point, we're about 5 hours into the outage. And as you can probably imagine, at this point, GitLab is just down. There's no more degraded. It's just everything is shut off and there's no database anymore. And so the focus at this point shifts into recovery. So, you know, GitLab, as you do, started scanning what backup options they had. And so, As Tom mentioned, setting context early on, they did have a nightly PG dump job that was running and then was uploading backups into a bucket in S3. So they went to check that bucket, and that sinking feeling is about to come back. The bucket was empty, so there was nothing in the S3 bucket. So this is probably another moment to panic for the poor team at this point as they're running around looking at what's happening. And so they eventually figured out that that when they initially set this all up, it was all working great. And the S3 bucket probably had an eviction policy because they were rotating backups. And when they set it up, it was some time ago, and they were running Postgres version 9.2. And so they had the Postgres daemon running on the database server running 9.2, and they had pgdump running on a kind of compute machine running 9.2. And at some point after they declared victory and moved on, they had upgraded the database server to version 9.6, but it had been missed to double back and make sure that the pgdump version was also upgraded. And it ends up that when pgdump connects to a database running a different version than itself, it errors out and refuses to run. So pgdump had not been successfully completing a dump for some period of time, and there was nothing left in the S3 bucket.
Oof. Oh, man.
Yeah. you can totally see how you get to this spot, but it's tough. Once you realize you're there, it's a pretty hard day. So they did have, you know, a way to make sure that the jobs were succeeding here. So this job was being run as part of a cron tab, and they had email set up to email on a non-successful invocation of a cron tab. The error output should have been emailed to an email address where an operational team would know and help fix it. However, bad gets worse. These emails were being attempted to be sent by the cron daemons, but they had switched over to using DMARC for email authentication at the GitLab domain. And so at some point, these cron error emails, they were not set up to using DMARC. They were missed. And so they were getting silently dropped instead of being delivered. And so despite the fact that there were error emails being attempted to be sent about these failing backups, those emails were not being successfully delivered because they were not utilizing email authentication on the domain.
Yeah, and you can totally imagine how this would happen. You know, just as employees come in and out, you know, there's somebody that's used to getting these emails. Then maybe, you know, they change roles or they leave the company. The new people don't know that these emails exist. If that happens at the same time, the DMARC change goes in. You know, just it's so easy to imagine how that gets lost.
Yep. So, all right. So S3 backups not available. So as you may recall, staging had a snapshot, and there was a policy, there was a system in place to create these snapshots every 24 hours. At this point, the snapshot would have been about 24 hours old, which is sort of worst case scenario. And luckily, as we mentioned earlier in the timeline, in order to do this PG pool testing, an engineer had taken a more recent snapshot that was only about 6 hours old at this point. So this LVM snapshot that was propagated into staging and was the staging database was running it was their best option at this point. So in fact, it was their only option.
Yeah. I have been in the industry for a while. Maybe things have changed, but at some point it was not okay just to take a disk snapshot of a bunch of B trees and use that. Like I don't think Postgres guarantees that it writes everything out in a consistent state. So I'm sort of horrified by this, but you know, clearly there wasn't an alternative. So
that's right. You know. Yeah. Any port in a storm. Yeah. But yeah, it's not super safe to back databases up this way. Yeah. Cause I agree with you. I think the guarantees about the stability of that are not ironclad. So, but you know, it was available and, was an option they could use, and so they did. So they began looking into basically going the other direction, which is not their usual direction, and bringing this LVM snapshot back out of staging and restoring production with it. Unfortunately, one more complexity arose, which was the staging cluster were using cheaper versions of resources, including the disk was a slower network-based disk instead of like a fast SSD or whatever. And so the bandwidth coming off of those disks is pretty limited. So in order to copy the database back out of staging and restore it into production, this LVM snapshot, it was going to take about 18 hours to copy the snapshot from staging back into production. So which would obviously increase their downtime. And the nature of the cloud provider they were using, Azure, the way that they do these classes of resources, it was not possible to just upgrade on the spot to a premium storage option. So they had, once again, this was the option available to them, so they took it. So they had these 18 hours to restore production from staging, and then add that to the 5+ that they were down under load. And about 24 hours after the outage started, they were back online. So the snapshot was restored. Postgres was started again. They had a couple of details to care of. Like, for example, they probably issued some unique IDs out of an auto increment range that may have been retained by external systems. So they had to kind of skip over like 100,000 auto increment IDs to prevent any kind of collisions. But then 24 hours later, they're back online. So total consequences here, 24 hours of outage and about 6 hours of data lost, which ended up affecting some, 5,000 or so like customers, in various ways. So yeah, big hard day at GitLab reading through. Yeah. Lots of PTSD here.
If this happened to me, I would definitely be recording a screenshot of what my Apple Watch is telling me my heart rate was over the, that would be so rough. So,
and Tom and I were talking before the podcast and talking about that moment when you were in the wrong shell when you ran the deletion, and both of us having been there at one point in our careers. And at that moment, you need to stand up and walk away from the keyboard and you need to let a colleague sit down and take over. You probably need to go take a walk, get some tea, get a Coke, because you're going to be a little shook up for a little while. That Apple Watch would be spiking a lot right about then.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That sometimes you just have to settle down and like take a break. Like, you're okay. Things are going to be down for a while. Let's not make things any worse.
Yep. Yeah. You sort of enter into a new class of outage, and probably the first right motion is actually for everybody to take a breath for a second and regroup. So, okay. Well, there's the timeline.
that was a pretty intense timeline. So as we usually do, let's run through things that went well, and then we'll have a section on things that might've gone a little bit better.
Sounds great.
So for the stuff that went well, I mean, bad things happen, and like that's just how life is sometimes. And, at that point you're going to be judged somewhat. And so the way you're going to get judged really is on the recovery, like how you explain what happened and how you just sort of, tell the world what went on. And so I give GitLab huge props for the transparency on dealing with this outage. They actually had a live document they were updating, while the outage was going on, which I don't know if I would want to do that because it might just distract the team a lot. But they did that, and then they had just an incredibly thorough postmortem. And I mean, one of the reasons we picked this one is not to pick on GitLab or anything, but just because it was such a great postmortem. But this is, this kind of transparency is how you rebuild that trust.
Yeah.
It's how that you make people understand that, we've learned our lessons, and I promise you this is not going to happen again. And, certainly everyone involved in this incident is not going to do it again. Like, these are lessons that will stick with you for decades. So,
yep.
So that's the first thing I want to point out. It's just really, really well done on the transparency front.
Yeah, a lot of transparency. And I think the positioning about accountability was appropriate, too, in terms of the CEO was the voice in the postmortem and someone claiming responsibility. And, I saw senior folks from GitLab on places like Hacker News responding to feedback and stuff like that, and really just owning the mistake. Right. Because like Tom said, mistakes are going to happen. mistakes do happen. That's, it's part of life. But like seeing the company not shirk its responsibility at all to like its customers, to like be very clear about what the mistakes were, what they're going to do about it, and owning that responsibility was really impressive in this circumstance.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So the next thing that went well is, they had a staging environment, and that is what saved them. That like if I mean, honestly, if they had not had the staging environment, I think the company would have been gone. I mean, I don't know how you would recover from... I mean, I guess you could start like actually doing like disk recovery and opening up, you know, pgbtree.c and like trying to just extract the raw data. But I mean, then you're talking about like weeks of outage of downtime versus days. And, you know, I think it would have been very hard to come back from that. So, you know, they had built a staging environment. Like, that's not free. That takes engineering work, and which is just a great thing for, you know, validating changes, you know, about making sure code is safe before it goes out. So I kudos to them for having put in the work to have a staging environment, which, although this was never its goal, it did end up arguably saving the company.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that the staging environment existing is great, and obviously was yet another backstop. And even, you know, even though obviously like the monitoring of it, it looks like the backups were not working successfully, and we sort of know why now, but the company having a little bit of layers of redundancy here on, you know, you have a replica, you have 24-hour database dumps, you have a disk level snapshot. I mean, the truth is, if you have a critical asset like your primary database, like you want to have multiple diverse ways that it's made, that it's redundant. And so, you know, LVM snapshots succeed and fail in a different way than PG dump running on the command line fails versus like online replication. And so it just, that set of diverse ways to represent the same data, like makes it significantly less likely that they all fail at the same time. Right. So you could imagine instead, just as a contrast, right, you had only online replication, but you had like 9 replicas, you know, in 3 different geographies, right? You might say, oh my gosh, I have so many copies of the data, right? But all it takes is one delete command that goes across all of them to make that, yeah. You know, or one bad bug in Postgres or whatever, right? So even if Postgres had the bug, for example, right, LVM disk snapshotting would not, right? It's not correlated with bugs in Postgres. So the fact that they did have a few different ways that this data was in multiple places ultimately saved them, as Tom said before, right? The staging environment being one of those places. So when 2 out of 3 of these representations failed, the third one still, you know, saved the day.
Yep. Yep. All right. So let's get into things that might've gone a little bit better and maybe some lessons other people can take away from this just to help, you know, lower average heart rates across the industry. this is definitely an outage that had 2 distinct phases. You know, that there was the time when it was an availability outage, you know, where just the site wasn't available. And then it transitioned into a, you know, data loss outage when the bad command got issued. And so, you know, this is so understandable, like, and so predictable when you're under stress, when things are moving fast and you have that pressure to get the site back up and running. It's worth thinking about multiple different ways you can prevent issuing a bad command in an outage. So, you know, one thing I like to do, even when I'm not in an outage, like if I'm doing anything on a database that is remotely scary, I will get on a VC with somebody and have them actually look at the commands I'm typing just to make sure that, you know, somebody else can just okay it. Like we have code review for all the code, but you should sort of think of an equivalent thing for typing in commands. Like come up with the equivalent for code review for your CLI when it's really important.
Yep. Yeah, I think that some of the firefighting scenarios I've been in that have been the most successful, you know, there's this is in an office environment, but there are VC equivalents, right? There's someone that's driving, and then there's usually at least 1 or 2 people sort of looking over their shoulder. And like just a pause before you hit enter and saying, does it look good? You know, and just getting an ack from your other engineers around you is one way when you're under fire to just, because especially there's an extra anxiety the person at the keyboard feels, because it has this visceral thing that like you're the one that's supposed to be fixing it, right? And it's a little bit clearer head sometimes the folks that don't have their hands on a keyboard have, because it feels a little bit less directly accountable for making a mistake, right? So that sometimes that the person watching you work will be the one to catch the, oh wait, are you, aren't you on the wrong server? Right. So, yeah.
I read this on the internet a long time ago, but somebody had this great story about how on US Navy submarines, you know, which are, I think, all nuclear powered, you know, there's people in charge of the reactor, and, you know, there's a big panel of stuff, but then below the panel, there's a brass bar. And when something is not right, you know, it's the sailor's job to put their hands on the brass bar and not touch anything until they figure out what's going on. like it's an actual physical place to, you know, put your hands to where you don't just start, you know, flipping switches and potentially breaking something. And so I love that story, but then I asked a guy I knew who was actually on a sub about that, and he said that was BS. So.
I love that story too. I'm a little disappointed that's not real.
but it's still a good story.
Right. Yeah. We need the DevOps equivalent of the brass bar, right? So,
right. Right.
Yeah. So I mean, I think one of the things on this topic, right, is like there's just that, and like we can explore some like sort of increasingly sophisticated ways to think about these kind of like bad commands. Like certainly having a coworker looking at it with you is a relatively low tech way to sort of build some in, but maybe there's some others we can talk about, Tom, that sort of ramp up the sophistication of preventing this.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the easiest things you can do is just have different prompts in all of your machines, all your environments, you know, like, it's pretty easy to set up just like a different color prompt so that, you know, and this can automatically happen when your EC2 servers or whatever get deployed, you know, just when the machine gets set up, it just puts a command into the profile such that if you're on prod, it's red. If you're on your staging environment, it's yellow or something like that. And it's just a visual cue that, you know, things are different here. And of course, you know, you hopefully you're not spending so much time in a prod shell that you get just accustomed to it. But, you know, this is just another sort of really cheap and easy layer you can put on top of things. Just, you know, it's defense in depth. Just one more thing.
Yep. Yeah. And, another like slightly more sophisticated thing you could do as well in invest in is there's a practice of making sure that deletes are like soft deletes that move things out of the way by default, right? As much as like folks may, you know, giggle a little at the concept of the recycle bin, especially back in the day, right? I think at this point in retrospect, we have to say there's a lot of merit to this pattern, right? And so, you know, for example, on your database servers, it may be that you don't really want it possible to just RM without that having the default, unless someone opts in to essentially move it to some sort of like, you know, quarantine area that's eventually evicted. So, you know, the human side would just be get in a habit of doing MV if possible instead of RM, right? And then a tooling one would be, you know, try to have your RMs actually be MVs in critical environments.
Yeah. And you know, I think at the really high end, you know, hopefully all of your machines at some point in your company's life, all your machines should be tracked in some kind of database that knows what they are, you know, and machines that are a primary for a database, you know, you can have tools that are built into that database to where when you're on your primary application database, you know, you should ideally you would have tools that check your machine database and are a little bit more restrictive of what you can do when that's the primary, you know, so like in a perfect world, you would have to demote the primary to be a secondary before you could really delete anything, something like that.
Yep. Yeah. We like it in production. We've had things set up well enough, that you can go as far as if you can invest in it and you have the time and you're at that level of maturity and all that to use like the Linux capability system in order to make it so that like even root can't remove files in the data directory. And so only using the RM command, right? So only like blessed tools can execute those commands, and those tools check your machine database to tell is this machine currently a primary, right? Yep. You can even, you know, we had a tool set up at one point where it would actually connect, you know, check whether or not something was bound on port 5432 or whatever, right? So like if the database is running, it will not, you know. So there's different kinds of checks you can make to plumb into the clusters concept of is this a primary and have it essentially refuse to run tools that can destroy data if that is true, because that was almost definitely a mistake if you attempted to do that.
Yeah, but before you build any of that stuff, make sure you have a successful business.
For sure, yeah. All of this is sort of like, you can get a long way with just like practices and really inexpensive things like different prompts before you get into like, you know, making it so that root can't do things based on machine database tags or whatever. Like that's a great place to be in, but that does take a lot of investment to get there.
Yep. Okay, so the second kind of umbrella of stuff, you know, it's just the thing you need to really internalize is that if something's not tested, it doesn't work. And I mean, this is something we're going to come back to time and time again in this podcast, I expect, which is, you know, if something's not consistency checked, it's probably inconsistent. If something's not tested, it probably doesn't work. If you haven't restored your databases recently, your restores don't work. It's just, it's the safest way to think about things. And it's making time for it that's usually the hard problem.
Yeah, and it's a part of like making sure you're checking for things that are at the end, ideally, of the dependency chain and not some intermediate point, right? So like one way to express this, you could say, is like if you can restore a backup, the backup worked, right? You know, so <Yeah. laughs> and then if you think that combination of thinking, if we don't test it, it doesn't work, and are we actually testing the outcome we're looking for, right? Like, if you think of it that way, it almost doesn't make sense to spend too much time checking whether you, quote unquote, did backup successfully, because in order to know that blob that you put in the object store is not garbage, right, you have to try to restore it. In order to know it, you know how to restore it, you have to restore it, right? So the purpose of the backup is not to have a file in S3. The purpose of the backup is to be able to restore the database. So, like, you have to test that. Otherwise, you're not really testing anything, right, if you don't do that.
I think that's just a really great way of putting it, is, you know, like, think about the outcomes you care about and evaluate whether or not those outcomes are working, you know, not whether or not the intermediate steps are. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, basically, like, DRT type exercises where you do disaster recovery simulations are great to do as a team every now and then, where you just say, oh, hey, we're gonna use PG base backup, you know, this week, right? And so, and that way you sort of discover ahead of time the lessons you need to know, or if the person's not around that knows how it really works, you can just take a note and get the answer later, or like asynchronously, as opposed to needing that person to be available like under fire when you have a deadline. So, you know, things like that where, not all these things have to be automated, but automation, obviously, in the long run is great. Like, automating restorations are something a lot of companies do. And that's amazing. If you can make sure that what you restore is a meaningful subset of your data, like, for example, you could replicate it to the primary successfully, that probably means your restoration worked. So, but even lacking that, again, down this maturity spectrum and the size of your team and stuff like that, just try it. So yeah. get a calendar and like make sure once a quarter or whatever your team uses uses the tools to bring your database back online from S3, or uses PG base backup to rebuild a secondary from the primary.
Yeah, I think there's that is all great stuff. But I think the higher level point I want to make here too is that that this is really an ownership thing. Like, none of this stuff is technically hard. There just has to be somebody that cares about making it happen. Like, there has to be someone whose job it is. I mean, ultimately that's the CEO, but you know, hopefully they will have delegated that to somebody and said, "This is now your job. I want to hear what you've done." But yeah, somebody needs to own this, and that's where it all begins.
Yeah, and I think I agree with that. And another thing is being pretty familiar with these teams, find a way to celebrate it too. So, because this ends up being the kind of work that again, nobody notices unless it goes wrong. And if you're doing the preventive work, it's hard to illustrate the value of it, right? Because it's like, well, we did the work, so we don't know whether it was necessary, right? Nothing did go wrong. Right. So it can kind of fall in that. So as a leader, an engineering leader, or as a team in a culture, or yes, the CEO of the company or whatever, you need to make sure also there's a way to sort of like value and celebrate this work, like so that the teams that are doing this preventative work feel like they're not trading that off against more valuable work where they like made features, right? You have to find a way to celebrate the preventative stuff.
And the DRTs are also a neat way of, like, I wouldn't say onboarding people, but taking people that are maybe a few months or a few, like a month or two into learning about a system and really deepening their understanding of it, because that, you know, that's when you might have to really be on your toes a little bit more and learn about the system pretty quickly, is trying to actually, you know, practice a recovery of something.
So right. Makes sense.
A lot of people never have to learn that stuff until, you know, the people that already knew it are gone. And then it gets a lot harder. So,
yep.
All right, let's get on the next point. Databases are really, really, really important for businesses these days. And yeah, that's not a place you ever want to skimp. You know, like, if you have the money, it's a good place to spend money. Is, you know, like, I mean, better databases make your generally everything faster, you know, better storage, you know, like in this case, if they'd been able to keep more of the transaction log around, then they might have been perfectly fine. You know, if they'd had a faster network connection to where the LVM snapshot were stored, a faster disk there, things, you know, that they wouldn't have had as much downtime. But more importantly, if you can pay somebody else to deal with your databases, please do.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. I mean, I think that the data, you know, the database in many respects is the company, right? Like, the company's assets are the things customers have given you, you know, and you keep for them and you represent to them and you move that data through workflows to, like, enrich it. And if there's one place you should really make sure you're doing whatever you can to, like, not have to worry about it, it's your databases. And also too, it's correlated with, it's one of the harder things to get right as well, right? Because, like, honestly, in the face of all the things can go wrong in a network, like, things like replication and backup and recovery procedures and latency, like, how, you know, a lot of times companies, even if they have, like, it was kind of like what happened to GitLab, even if they have amazing backups, the first time they have to restore those backups is the first time they learn it will take 3 days to restore the backup, right? And so, you know, so that's something you should probably know ahead of time, or you should just have someone that knows the magic to make that only take, or to make it so you never know that occurred, right? Like, ideally, if you're using a high-level service provider, they have disks fail all the time too. You never really know about that, right? So I think databases are one of the things that, like, in very few circumstances should you try to do that yourself. It's just really, really hard. And I say that having been in charge of teams that did that on tens of thousands of database servers. Like, the list of edge cases is incredibly long, and yet the criticality of doing it correctly is very, very high. And if you can pay someone to do that for you, it's probably one of those things. It's like a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, databases sneak up on you because they start out very simple. You know, like, everything is fast to start with. You know, everything is easy. You know, there are just no problems. You know, there are no edge cases to start with. But as things grow, you know, that's like, it's more complicated than you think. You know, it's generally how I would put it.
Yes, very, very complicated, especially at scale. Yep. So pay somebody to do it for you, and you will pay a premium for that. But I think when it comes to your database, it's worth it.
Yep. Yep. All right, and the last kind of bucket we want to talk about, put things into, is just a general philosophy around notifying the right person when something's gone wrong, you know?
Yep, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, it, you know, when something goes wrong, how do you know about it? And how do you know about it reliably? And how many different ways are there to discover that? And it's another one of these things where it's so important for that to actually work. Like, something went wrong, now someone knows that can take action on it. If at all possible, you want to make it so there's only one way that happens, right? So, you know, the opposite of this, right? Like, just to illustrate what this actually means, is, like, you have a metrics oriented thing that pages when things cross thresholds, and then you have error logs, right? That people should check their email, right? So, not to pick on GitLab, but that's probably kind of what we're describing here, right? So, having one way that whenever anything goes wrong, someone will know about it is great, because you can harden that one way, and it's much more likely that one way won't fail than if you have three or four ways And like one, but one of them is used 90% of the time, and the other ones are used less than 10 collectively. Like those ones that use less than 10 are just way more likely, like economically, to break and for people not to notice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
No, I think. Yeah, once you have this one way of doing things, like then you can really invest in making that just completely bulletproof. You know, like if you can have like, you know, inject synthetic errors and make sure this one way is picking them up. You know, like you can have systems that detect, you know, that this thing isn't running and then alert you based on that. You know, so yeah, just have one way of getting errors to you and make sure that that's working.
Yeah. So, I mean, the you know, if this is originating from error logs in this circumstance forever, like that's totally okay. But then like use something that like turns those error logs into metrics or whatever. So use things like Logstash or Vector or lots of other solutions that like can basically turn, you know, Datadog if using a hosted thing, logs into metrics. And then I think the other thing that's a little bit more in the weeds, but like about these kinds of systems is like, if you need to know something is wrong because something tells you it's wrong, like that pattern usually is more fragile than ringing the phone unless you know something is right. And so like the example here, it really oftentimes has to do with metric systems, right? We already talked about that. And then what does a missing value mean, right? So like if we take a database backup, and this is again based on like actual teams I've worked on, so I'm stealing a little bit here, right? But you know, a great thing to test is like basically ring the phone unless there's a value in seconds from the last time a database was like restored or backed up, or again, restored is ideal. If it was less than 2 days or like whatever your threshold is, right? And so nominally, like what this means is if it's more than 2 days, page someone, right? Or if the data, if the value is missing, page someone, right? So unless a system emits a value that says some, because what otherwise can happen is the system that checks that just stops working, right? And so you just, you don't get the an error occurred type value. So it's kind of in making sure you're inverting that. It's not about like ring the phone if an error happens. It's ring the phone unless you got data that said everything worked. And yeah, if you can shape your systems that way, they're just going to be a lot more robust to the type of like missed signal problems that occur when like something quietly stops running. Yeah, I guess that would be the recommendation in this area. In my experience, works pretty well for these kinds of systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree. Cool. Oh, well, cool. Anything else you want to call out from this one, Jamie?
No, I think that's other than, you know, reading through it, I was like edge of my seat. You know, I think we've all been there with, you know, when it seems like one thing goes wrong after another, and you know, the resiliency teams have to show to like get the site back online when things like this are happening. It's it can end up really pulling the team together, right? So because
as shared struggle.
Shared struggle. And as you said, the team emerges from the other side just so much stronger and wiser, right? They're hard lesson learned, but their lessons learned really deeply. And I'm sure one of the things GitLab did, and if you look at all their follow-up items, it looks like they have, is you not only have the individuals learn it, right? But those individuals help build it into the culture, right? They, you know, so that it's not just those individuals that make that mistake again, but the company really won't, right? The company has become stronger at this kind of problem.
Yeah, and GitLab is still in business. They're still going strong. So like, I think they did the right things and they survived. So, and again, big kudos to them for being so open about this kind of just really, really, really rough 24 hours.
Definitely. So, yep.
Well, cool. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back with another episode soon.
Thanks for listening to The Downtime Project. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you'd like to read a transcript of the show or leave a comment, visit us at downtimeproject.com. You can follow us on Twitter @SevReview. And if you like the show, we'd appreciate a 5-star review.